Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Tuesday, November 8th, 2022. Election Day 2022. Control of the U.S. House and Senate on the line, as well as many governor's races across the country. And this year, campaigns for, in previous years, overlooked state offices like Secretary of State getting a lot more attention since they are often the ones that oversee the ballot counting. Just ahead, reporters in Pennsylvania and Nevada talk about when results of the closely watched and close in the pre-election voter polls, U.S. Senate races there, will be known. It may not be tonight. And looking at ballot initiatives across the country, we'll speak with Elections Project Manager at the National Council of State Legislatures. United Nations Climate Summit continues in Egypt. We will talk with a Wall Street Journal reporter who looks at the intersection of climate and finance about the big issues there. And a Climate Summit working group today releasing a report criticizing corporations for being deceitful in their greenhouse gas emission reduction commitments, what is called greenwashing. U.S. Special Envoy for Climate John Kerry seen today shaking hands in Egypt with Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. State Department says it was unplanned. And the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky hinting at the possibility of peace talks with Russia to end the war. Now to Election Day 2022, reminder that C-SPAN's live coverage tonight starts at 8 p.m. Eastern. Find out which party will control Congress. Hear results as they happen from the U.S. House, U.S. Senate, and governor's races across the country. And you'll hear the victory and concession speeches from the candidates. That'll be on C-SPAN Radio, C-SPAN Television, streamed at C-SPAN.org, and on the free C-SPAN Now mobile app. The first polls close about 6 p.m. Eastern in parts of Indiana and Kentucky. Then at 7 p.m. Eastern, the rest of those two states, plus Georgia, South Carolina, Vermont, Virginia, and Florida. Virginia Congresswoman Abigail Spanberger, a Democrat running for re-election, joined Virginia Senator Tim Kaine, also a Democrat, urging people to vote today.
Hey, Tim Kaine here at Freedom High School in Prince William County with Abigail running for the 7th District. It's so exciting to be with her on Election Day.
We have been at the polls greeting people. It's an exciting time. If you have not gotten out to vote yet, the polls are open until 7 p.m. It's exciting. Happy Election Day, everybody. And we look forward to success.
Congresswoman Spanberger and Senator Tim Kaine, that video posted by Senator Kaine. At 7:30 p.m. Eastern, more state polls close, North Carolina, Ohio, and West Virginia. And then at 8 p.m. Eastern, when C-SPAN's live coverage begins, polls close in 19 more states, including New Hampshire. Governor Chris Sununu, a Republican running for re-election, spoke to reporters after he cast his ballot.
Is this your last run for governor here in New Hampshire?
Oh, who knows? Who knows? I'm just focused on the next 2 years. If I'm, you know, so lucky to get elected today, and I think we're going to turn out pretty well. I think we've worked really hard. We've made sure folks just talk about the issues, understand our record of success. We've put our New Hampshire in a position to be better than pretty much 49 other states, and that's a pretty awesome thing. So we'll see how it turns out today.
I got to ask about the former president making some big news last night, teasing that a week from today, Donald Trump will have a really big announcement down at Mar-a-Lago. Do you think it's right for Trump or anybody thinking about running for president to announce that early? And if he does get in next week, does he clear the field?
I don't think anyone really cares, and he does not clear the field, no. Everyone that wants to run is still going to run. I think I said this past weekend, anyone who thinks it's a smart idea to announce an election, a potential presidential bid, after the election, but before Christmas, it's just the worst time you could possibly do it. So my sense is the former president needs better advisors if that's really what his strategy is going to be.
New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu, Republican, running for re-election with reporters today after he voted. Former President Trump made that comment about the big announcement a week from today. He made it Monday night in Ohio, a last day rally. President Biden did not have any public events today. The White House says he had a full schedule and that he dropped in on a virtual Democratic National Committee phone bank to thank staff and volunteers and then spoke by phone individually with various Democratic leaders, including the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Congressman Sean Patrick Maloney, chair of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, Senator Gary Peters, chair of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, and also the DNC chair, Jamie Harrison. Vice President Kamala Harris was in Los Angeles with Congresswoman Karen Bass, a Democrat who is running for Los Angeles mayor.
And one of the most important expressions of love of country is to vote.
Yes.
And to participate.
Yes.
As part of our civic duty and our,
yes,
responsibility, our individual responsibility to uphold our democracy. One of the great ways we do that is by getting out to vote.
Vice President Kamala Harris in Los Angeles, along with Congresswoman Karen Bass, a candidate for L.A. mayor. California polls close at 11 p.m. Eastern. But the Secretary of State there, Shirley Weber, putting out a statement: by law, county election officials have 30 days to count every valid ballot and conduct a post-election audit. We have a process that by law ensures both voting rights and the integrity of elections. So I would call on all Californians to be patient. The last state polls to close tonight: Hawaii, that's midnight Eastern time, and then Alaska, 1 a.m. Eastern going into Wednesday. Virtually all sitting members of Congress tweeting encouragement to voters to get out to the polls today. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Democrat, with this: decisions are made by those who show up, and I want you to have a seat at the table. Voting is your right and your responsibility. The House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, Republican, who could become Speaker if Republicans get the majority, with a one-word tweet: vote, capital letters with an exclamation point. House Republicans need 5 seats for that majority, and we may know by the end of the night if that's happened. But over in the Senate, which is now evenly split, 50 Democrats, 50 Republicans, with Vice President Kamala Harris, who's president of the Senate, breaking the tie now in favor of the Democrats. Republicans need just 1 seat to flip that and get the majority. But tonight there may not be a definitive outcome. There are at least 6 Senate races that have been neck and neck in polls for a while. And one of them in Georgia, between incumbent Democrat Raphael Warnock and Republican challenger Herschel Walker, if neither gets over 50% of the vote, and there is a third party candidate that may cause that, that would go to a runoff election in a couple of weeks. And in many of the other close Senate races, vote counting may not finish tonight. In Pennsylvania, there's an open seat, no incumbent, and Republican Mehmet Oz faces Democrat John Fetterman. C-SPAN spoke with J.D. Prose, PennLive.com, state political reporter.
We're seeing reporting on a story about an election lawsuit dealing with the mail-in votes that have lacked dates on their ballots. What was the issue there, and what's being done to resolve that?
The issue, as you said, is undated mail-in ballots, and the Pennsylvania Supreme Court has decided and ruled that those ballots should be set aside and not counted. Mail-in ballots are overwhelmingly used by Democratic voters. So last night, the John Fetterman campaign and Democratic campaign arms and a couple of Democratic voters from Erie County, I believe, joined in on a federal lawsuit to get those votes counted. And because obviously in a race like this, that's expected to be so tight, you know, literally every vote could count. And if, you know, there are thousands or tens of thousands of ballots out there that would not be counted under this ruling, that could make a huge difference in this race.
The Washington Post has a chart this morning on how long it took 5 key states to count the vote in 2020, showing Pennsylvania as the longest count. Pennsylvania, all ballots were counted 20 days after the election in 2020. What do officials anticipate in terms of the vote count this time around? What have they done to expedite that?
Don't expect any results tonight, I think, is the advice. Because of the mail-in ballot situation here in Pennsylvania, county election offices can't begin canvassing mail-in ballots, or canvassing, another word for processing. They can't begin that until this morning. And so you have this huge turnout of mail-in ballots. 1.4 million mail-in ballots were requested. I believe over 1 million have already been returned. So, you know, you have this situation, really a repeat of 2020, when you have this huge influx of mail-in ballots. Counties can't process them simply because of the manpower and the influx of mail-in ballots. And so those are usually and typically counted later in the day and at night or tomorrow. And so, you know, we could be looking at a few days, several days maybe, depending on the situation with the court case that you and I discussed earlier with the undated mail-in ballots.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it just, it's really a replay of 2020, hopefully not to the extent that, like you said, we're 20 days out with no results. Hopefully it's not that bad. But it goes back to the counties not being given more time to process the mail-in ballots by the state legislature.
J.D. Prose is with PennLive.com, state political reporter, joining C-SPAN on this morning's Washington Journal. Pennsylvania polls close at 8 p.m. Eastern, but the law that says anyone in line to vote at that time will be allowed to vote, so even the in-person Election Day voting will not be finishing up until later. Nevada has another of the Senate races in the handful that polls say are so close that they will help decide which party ends up in the majority in the Senate. Incumbent Democrat Catherine Cortez Masto facing Republican challenger Adam Laxalt. We spoke with April Corbin Gurness, Nevada Current deputy editor.
Let's talk first about the change in the law. The way people vote in Nevada is all by mail now, correct?
Correct. We moved to mail ballots in 2020 in response to the pandemic, but then in 2021, state lawmakers decided to make it permanent. So this is our first time using it universally.
Yeah, so this is sort of uncharted territory for voters, obviously, but also for those of you who cover the election and results. How soon or how late do you expect to begin getting results on the elections there?
Well, our polls here open at 7 a.m. and then they close at 7 a.m. or 7 p.m. Obviously, if people are still in line, then the state won't release results until the last person is voted. In past years, it's been as early as like within the hour of 7, 8 o'clock. In past years, in busier years, it's been several hours later. Also, polls can be delayed. They're closing because of weather. So if we have bad weather, especially in the north and in rural parts of Nevada today, so we may see some polls that are delayed in opening, which means they'll be delayed in closing. So it could be several hours until we have in-person totals starting to come in today. But more importantly, because of mail ballots, it may be several days. I know people don't want to hear that, but here in Nevada, your ballot has to be postmarked by Election Day, but then it can be received and counted by the counties up until Saturday, November 12th. And then 2 days after that on Monday is the last day for signature curing, which is what happens if signatures don't match or if somebody forgot to sign their mail ballot or something like that. So we may not have election results until Monday if races are as close as people are expecting them to be.
April Corbin Gurness, Nevada Current deputy editor on C-SPAN's Washington Journal. She mentioned 7 p.m. the polls closing. That's Nevada time, 10 p.m. Eastern. Aside from the candidates on the election ballots, many states putting referendums before the voters. We get more from Mandy Zock, election project manager with the National Council of State Legislatures.
A total of 141 ballot measures on the ballot this election cycle. 46 states will decide 133 measures today, Election Day. Five other ballot measures were voted on during the primary, and Louisiana will vote for three ballot measures in December. One of the notable ballot measures voted in the primaries was the abortion measure voted on by Kansas, correct?
Yes. Voters rejected an anti-abortion measure in Kansas. That measure is interesting and to me because it showed that the measure really drove turnout. So more people chose to vote on that ballot measure than in either of the Kansas primaries that were happening at the same time. It might drive turnout today.
It's coming up as an initiative in a total of what looks to be six states: California, Montana, Kentucky, Michigan, five states, and Vermont. Michigan, the initiative is getting the most attention. What are they proposing to do there?
So it's a proposal to enshrine the constitutional right to abortion in the state's constitution.
So in terms of the range of what a measure can like an abortion measure can do, it changes. We talked about changing the constitution What are some of the other measures doing? Kentucky, Montana, California.
Sure. So there are five that are being decided today. Three of those are pro-abortion measures. So those are the ones in Michigan, Vermont, and California. And then there are two anti-abortion measures, and those are in Montana and Kentucky. And so those would either prohibit the right to enshrine abortion as a right in the Constitution or make other kind of changes to limit abortion access.
And there are several states voting on marijuana legalization today.
Yes, five states today are going to decide whether marijuana can be legalized. And that's just for adult use. None of them are for medical.
And how does it compare with 2020 in terms of that particular topic, that sort of measure?
That's a good question. Off the top of my head, I don't remember how many marijuana measures there were in 2020. The fact that there are five this year is certainly a handful, but it's not the most that there has ever been. I think there eight might be the record for marijuana related measures.
In this role of yours as with the National Conference of State Legislatures, I don't want to say what's the oddest. What sort of struck you as the most unusual ballot measure to come up this year before state?
Good question. You know, California is always voting on dialysis. It's the only state that's ever had measures related to dialysis clinics. It has had a measure on that topic for the past 3 years. But I would say one of the most unusual is really Alabama this year is going to be certifying or ratifying, I should say, a new constitution. And we don't see that happen every day.
So they've written the constitution, the legislature, the convention there in Alabama has approved it, and now it goes to the state voters to approve that.
Yes, it's really just some fine-tuning and rearranging, recompiling, removing some outdated language. No major significant changes, but actually voters had to approve the legislature to have that power to begin with a different ballot measure a couple years ago.
Well, a lot has been talked about election security this election cycle. How many states are taking up measures that deal with the way a state conducts its election?
So there are about a dozen election-related measures this year, and I had to go back and check because it felt like there were more, but there really aren't more election-related measures than in the past. It's just that these measures are getting more attention than they have typically done in the past.
What sort of things do they do?
So we're looking at things like voter ID. Nebraska and Arizona both have measures related to that. Arizona would add additional identification requirements to absentee and mail ballots. Nebraska would establish a photo ID requirement for voting. States like Nevada are voting on ranked choice voting and changes to the primary system. I'll note that if they pass that, it's not final, and it actually has to be passed in two elections in a row in Nevada for that to take effect. And then there are measures related to prohibiting non-citizens from voting, early in-person voting in Connecticut. Kind of every hot-button election issue you could think of is going to be going to have some movement on it today.
Well, how does this year's 141 measures compare to 2020 and previous years?
So the numbers are actually a little lower than we typically see for the number of measures. 2020 was lower even than this year because of the pandemic. You know, thinking about why is this year lower, especially on the citizen initiative side, some of that might be because signature gathering is still affected by the pandemic. There are perhaps labor issues that have kept campaigns from hiring signature gatherers. And so we are really seeing far fewer citizen initiatives this year. The number of legislative measures are pretty much the same.
Mandy Zock, Elections Project Manager with the National Council of State Legislatures, joining C-SPAN on this morning's Washington Journal program. You can find the full discussion with her and all the other guests archived at our website, cspan.org. And again tonight, C-SPAN's live election night coverage begins at 8 p.m. Eastern, right here on C-SPAN Radio, also on C-SPAN Television, at cspan.org, or on our free mobile app, C-SPAN Now. John Kerry, U.S. Special Presidential Envoy on Climate, says that this year's midterm election results in the U.S. or any future election will not undo what the Biden administration has done to deal with climate change. John Kerry speaking at the United Nations Climate Summit in Egypt, known as COP27, which stands for Conference of the Parties, 27th meeting, dating back, the first one was 1995. John Kerry said, This is not a President Biden conjured up political exercise. This is not an ideological exercise. Everything we are choosing to do is based on science. He also spoke on the sidelines of the conference, praising the work of the private sector in controlling greenhouse gases.
Entrepreneurial activity is underrated in many places. And what we have been able to do as human beings through the course of history is unbelievable. And I have total confidence. There's so much now beginning to happen in technology. And people are beginning, I mean, whether it's green hydrogen or blue or battery storage or fusion, or and there's more money now going into venture capital to accelerate this transition. But nothing is going to have more impact, folks, than a bunch of companies that have to pay a payroll, you know, keep their workers moving in the right direction, be responsible to shareholders, account publicly for what they're doing. When you have so many companies around the world that are now in every boardroom coping with ESG and their new responsibilities, there's no law that requires people to do net 50 zero, none. But more and more companies are recognizing this is a public responsibility, and they have the ability to be able to make the difference in where we're going here. These first mover pioneers are unbelievable pathfinders here, because they're proving to the rest of the marketplace, where people are hesitant to invest for various reasons, hey, they're still standing. It works for them. They're able to meet their payroll. They're able to grow their business. They're able to expand the market and their market share. That's what's going to happen here. And they're first in the market.
John Kerry, U.S. Special Presidential Envoy on Climate, on the sidelines of the United Nations Climate Summit in Egypt. It was a program on the anniversary of the launch of the First Movers Coalition from the last climate change conference in Scotland. State Department says that coalition is a new platform for companies to harness their purchasing power and supply chains to create early markets for innovative clean energy technologies that are key for tackling the climate crisis. Elsewhere today at the UN Climate Conference in Egypt, release of a report that criticizes some companies that promise to reduce greenhouse gases and don't follow through. Catherine McKenna is the chair of the High-Level Expert Group on Net Zero Emissions Commitments of Non-State Entities.
So first, the good news. According to a recent report, over 80% of global emissions are covered by net zero pledges. And I want to give a huge shout out to the first movers, many of whom are in this room. Cities and regions that are reducing their emissions by transforming their grid with renewables and moving to district heating, building new public transit and cycling paths, retrofitting their buildings. Companies that are future-proofing themselves, investing in innovation and driving down emissions while supporting the businesses, often very small businesses, through their supply chain to do the same. Investors that are moving their investments from dirty to clean and investing in companies around the world that are building a cleaner future. But now the bad news. Too many of these net zero pledges represent little more than empty slogans and hype. And consumers are right to be skeptical. Just a few days ago, an Edelman report on trust and climate change, which surveyed 14,000 people and covered 14 countries, confirmed that business lags badly when it comes to green credentials. Nearly two-thirds of respondents believe companies are mediocre at, or worse at delivering their climate commitments, and fewer than half of people trust CEOs to tell the truth about climate change. Why is greenwashing so bad? In part, it's because the stakes are so high. It's not just false advertising. Bogus net zero claims drive up the cost that ultimately everyone will pay, including people who will pay the most, who are not in these rooms. They will pay that through huge impacts, through climate migration and with their very lives. Greenwashing also fuels public cynicism about climate issues and undermines one of the few mechanisms that we have to coordinate global action. And most of all, it threatens us ever reaching the goals that we have all agreed to in this room. The goals set out in the Paris Agreement, the goal of limiting warming to 1.5 degrees, and the promises that we all make to our kids and grandkids to ensure a sustainable future for them.
Catherine McKenna, chair of the UN expert group examining private sector commitments to reach net zero carbon emissions. She's also a former Canadian Minister of Environment and Climate Change. Wall Street Journal reporter Shane Shiflett, who covers finance and climate, has been covering the UN Climate Summit in Egypt, joining us now by phone. Thank you very much. Your article from a couple of days ago previewing COP27 begins this way. Last year's United Nations Climate Conference in Glasgow was full of disagreements, but it may be a high watermark for international cooperation on the issue. What challenges are there this year?
Well, I think some of the main challenges coming into this year's COP conference are really the war in Ukraine and the energy crisis that has resulted from it. You have a lot of interim goals that have been set over the previous conferences, and the world is not really meeting many of those targets so far, and it's becoming clear, I think, to negotiators and world leaders just how difficult a transition to sort of a cleaner global economy is going to be.
The issue that sort of popped up this year in a big way called loss and damage, compensation from developed nations to developing nations. What are the status of those talks?
Yeah, it's very contentious. Developed countries made a promise several COP conferences ago to basically help fund developing nations to help them sort of mitigate and enhance resilience from climate change. And those developed countries haven't been meeting that goal. So every year they're supposed to deliver about $100 billion to developing countries who are really sort of in the storm's eye when it comes to climate change and really facing some significant threats. And the developing world is asking for developed nations to pay up and to help them meet the crisis, where it's building on their shores.
Why was Egypt chosen for this year's summit?
The conference chooses a new venue each year, and sort of, you know, the leaders of that country are able to help set the agenda and scope for negotiations during the conference.
President Biden plans to be there later this week. What can we expect?
Well, his envoy, John Kerry, has started talking about ways to help the developing world finance clean energy projects. And Biden himself has signed a significant climate bill that will put the U.S. within striking distance of meeting some of its goals to transition its economy to using fewer fossil fuels. So there's going to be a lot of discussion probably around those achievements and how to help the developed world sort of build out clean energy infrastructure.
We're talking with Shane Shiflett, Wall Street Journal reporter. There was a report out today on greenwashing, a charge that private companies are not living up to their commitments. How big of an issue is that? And in terms of percentage, is it the private sector or the governmental actors that are doing the most to put carbon into the atmosphere?
So to address the greenwashing issue, I mean, corporate actors are increasingly setting net zero goals. They're trying to find ways to decarbonize their supply chains. It's very difficult. There's a lot of different ways that companies try to achieve the claims that they're making, and that is it creating, at the very minimum, sort of the appearance of greenwashing. And many of these private actors, you know, are operating in hard-to-abate sectors. And what I mean by that is, you know, without an airline basically stop, you know, not flying planes, it's going to be very difficult for that airline to decarbonize its business model. So those efforts to, you know, claim that they are operating carbon neutrally or they're net zero, it causes consumers to second guess whether or not how they're meeting those claims when it's clear that they're burning loads of fossil fuels.
When you write your story a week from now, when this summit is all over, what do you think the first line is going to be?
World leaders met to finally agree on how to foot the bill for climate change, and they're still trying to figure it out.
Shane Shiflett covers finance and climate and the intersection for the Wall Street Journal. You can find his stories at WSJ.com and on Twitter. It's at Shane Shiflett. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And some more headlines from COP27. This from Reuters. Developing countries need to work with investors, rich countries, and development banks to secure $1 trillion a year in external financing for climate action by the end of the decade and to match that with their own funds, report said. The report released ahead of the talks on climate change finance at the summit said the funding was required to cut emissions, boost resilience, deal with damage from climate change, and restore nature and land. And this from CNBC, the South Pacific island nation of Tuvalu on Tuesday urged countries at COP27 to establish a global treaty to phase out the use of fossil fuels. The low-lying country, which faces an existential threat from rising sea levels, is the first to make such a call at the UN's flagship climate conference. That from CNBC. Washington Today continues in a moment. Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts and on the free mobile app known as C-SPAN Now. Video of John Kerry, the U.S. Special Envoy for Climate, shaking hands with Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro at the UN Climate Summit in Egypt is circulating online. Reporter for Al Arabiya English, their Washington correspondent, Joseph Harbush, retweeting it and adding, President Biden's Special Presidential Envoy for Climate shakes hands and shares a few words with Venezuela's Nicolas Maduro, who is charged by the U.S. with corruption, narco-terrorism, and drug trafficking. Questions about all this today at the U.S. State Department briefing with spokesperson Ned Price.
On COP, do you have any thoughts or comment on former Secretary Kerry greeting and shaking hands with President Maduro of Venezuela?
Well, I think those of you who have seen the video will recognize that Nicolas Maduro, he interrupted what was an ongoing meeting at COP27 to engage Special Envoy Kerry. And this was very much an unplanned interaction, just in the same way that other world leaders have been presented with unplanned interactions from Nicolas Maduro. He briefly spoke to Special Envoy Kerry during COP27. This was not, as I said before, planned or substantive in any way. Maduro has, unfortunately, as it pertains to COP, overseen a period of significant environmental degradation, destruction of the Amazon through deforestation, through oil spills and illegal mining. And we believe it's in the interest of the entire region that such activities come to an end. But as far as that conversation goes, it was unplanned. It was non-substantive as well.
Okay, so the former Secretary Kerry was caught by surprise, and he was basically just being polite.
He was caught by surprise. I understand that Nicolas Maduro has done this to a number of world leaders. This was certainly not an interaction that was planned.
Who else has he done this to?
I am not going to put a spotlight on his other interactions, but you can check out some of the video that's available on social media.
Ned Price is the State Department spokesperson at his news conference today. Questions from Matt Lee from the Associated Press. Telesur English, that's a TV station based in Caracas, Venezuela, also tweeting the video of John Kerry and Nicolas Maduro meeting and shaking hands and describing the two as as, quote, they held a brief meeting. Now to Russia's war in Ukraine. AP Dateline Kyiv, Ukraine's president, has hinted at the possibility of peace talks with Russia, a shift from his earlier refusal to negotiate with President Vladimir Putin that came on the eve of crucial elections in the United States. Volodymyr Zelensky urged the international community late Monday to force Russia into real peace talks and listed his usual conditions for dialogue: the return of all of Ukraine's occupied lands, compensation for damage caused by the war, and the prosecution of war crimes. Here's President Zelensky speaking to his nation Monday night.
I delivered an important international address today, climate summit in Egypt, a very significant event, a very representative gathering, dozens of state leaders and heads of government. The main thing for us is to inform the world about the ongoing Russian aggression, about the destabilizing influence that Russia exerts. When the world is focused on combating war, energy and food crises, the destruction of customary international relations, the climate agenda is clearly suffering. And the destruction of the climate cannot somehow be put on hold. Therefore, anyone who is serious about the climate agenda should also be serious about the need to immediately stop Russian aggression, restore our territorial integrity, and force Russia into genuine peace negotiations. Into such negotiations, which we have repeatedly proposed, and to which we always received insane Russian responses with new terrorist attacks, shelling or blackmail. Once again, restoration of territorial integrity, respect for the UN Charter, compensation for all damages caused by the war, punishment of every war criminal and guarantees that this will not happen again. These are completely understandable conditions.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, part of his nightly address to his country, that from Monday, and the video and audio and the English interpretation provided by KyivPost.com. This from the New York Times. Even as Ukrainian officials celebrate the arrival of more advanced Western air defense systems and claim growing success at shooting down Russian rockets and drones, they are warning that Moscow is on the hunt for new long-range weapons against which Kyiv's forces have little defense, specifically ballistic missiles from Iran. This came up at the Pentagon briefing today with the press secretary, General Pat Ryder.
All right, let me go to Eric Schmidt, New York Times.
Thanks, Pat. You said you don't have any evidence yet that the Iranians have sent any kind of ballistic missiles to the Russians in Ukraine, but Ukrainian officials have now said there is a deal. They've confirmed that such a deal is in place with deliveries to come in November. Can you confirm that this deal is in place with deliveries to come? And then I have a second question.
Thanks, Eric. Again, I can't corroborate that information. I think I've mentioned before, when we see Iranian ballistic missiles being employed on the battlefield in Ukraine, we will do what we can to illuminate that. It does, again, though, point to the fact that Russia and Iran have a security assistance relationship, as evidenced by their employing Iranian drones on the battlefield. It's very concerning, and it does demonstrate the fact that both of these countries right now are targeting innocent civilians in Ukraine and extending the length of this conflict needlessly.
The second question is in related to this is that there's some media reports that the Russians sent over 100 million British pounds as well as three different kinds of Western weapon systems, Javelin and others. That were recovered in the battlefield. They were sent to Iran in exchange for some of the drones that they got. Can you confirm that?
Thanks, Eric. I have seen the press report, but I don't have any information to provide on that. Thank you.
Pentagon Press Secretary and Air Force Brigadier General Pat Ryder at the Pentagon News Conference today. Iran has denied plans to sell ballistic missiles to Russia. A top State Department official reports CNN said the Biden administration is confident that U.S. support for Ukraine will be unwavering and unflinching, no matter the results of the midterm elections in the U.S. The Assistant Secretary of State for the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs, Karen Donfried, spoke to reporters by the phone today. This is Washington Today. Holiday season and winter almost here. And today, the U.S. Surgeon General, Dr. Vivek Murthy, with another encouragement for eligible Americans to get the updated COVID-19 vaccine booster. Dr. Murthy, part of a webinar held by the Health and Human Services Department on helping specifically protect people with disabilities, seniors, and others with a greater risk of serious illness from COVID.
For all of this progress that we have made, the challenge is now for us to sustain that protection, especially as winter comes. If you look at the last couple of years, what we have seen during each of the last two winters is that there's been an increase in cases. And that's not unusual. We know in general in the winter, we tend to see other viruses like flu and RSV spread as well. But we've seen this consistently with COVID. And so what we've got to do now is to make sure that people utilize these tools, these vaccines and treatments in particular, to make sure that they're protected as winter approaches. A lot of vaccines, even if they work well, sometimes they wane with time, which means that you need a booster shot. If you've ever gotten a tetanus booster shot, you're familiar with that. If you get your annual flu shot, you're also familiar with the idea that you sometimes need to get updates to your vaccines. With COVID, it's similar. And the good news is that we have an updated vaccine that's now available for people ages 5 and up to take. And anyone who's at least 2 months or more out from their last shot is eligible to get that updated vaccine. And I certainly got that vaccine. My wife and did, my parents did. I urged my sister to and her husband, everybody I knew, because I know that this is one of the most powerful steps that we can take to protect ourselves against hospitalization and death from COVID if there indeed is a winter surge. So that's really important for us to do. And if you've gotten sick recently with COVID-19, you can still get vaccinated after waiting for about 3 months. That's about the time that we'd recommend. Let your body recover, and then you can get that shot 3 months after your infection. But the bottom line is COVID is continuing to evolve. That's why our vaccines and treatments are continuing to evolve. But we've got to use them in order for them to do their most important job, which is to save our lives and to keep us out of the hospital. A few last things that I just want to draw your attention to. One is that while we want everybody to get the protection from this virus that our tools afford, the people we in particular want to focus on are those at highest risk. And those are people who are 65 years of age and older, those who are immunocompromised, and people who have multiple other medical conditions that may put them at higher risk. So if you fall into that category, or if you have a family member who falls into that category, please encourage them, urge them to get vaccinated as soon as possible. And they can go to vaccines.gov or COVID.gov and find more information about where to get vaccinated, as well as in the case of COVID.gov, find places to get treated if you indeed do come down with the virus. And I would lastly just say this too. We've been talking about COVID, but we also want you to go out and get your flu shot because flu season is upon us. We're already seeing cases rise in other parts of the country. Thankfully, we have a vaccine for flu. We also have treatments for flu. And you can get both of these vaccines at the same time.
Dr. Vivek Murthy is U.S. Surgeon General, speaking today at a webinar hosted by the Health and Human Services Department at the COVID data tracker site at cdc.gov. They note that the number of people who have gotten the updated COVID-19 booster shot is 26.2 million, and that's 8.4% of the eligible population age 5 and up. And they also have a weekly case tracker, 273,000 cases and deaths, 2,500. Wall Street Today, the Dow up 333, NASDAQ up 51, S&P up 21. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Sign up for C-SPAN's evening newsletter, Word for Word, to get the top stories Washington is talking about sent to your inbox every day. You can subscribe at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night.